Hi, and welcome to the VFX Show podcast. This is Mark Christensen. I'm filling in this week for Mike Seymour, who not only has been traveling around the world, literally, but I believe has been predominantly in countries where he hasn't been able to see this week's film, which we'll get to in a moment. But first, I want to introduce my guest, John. Hello, John.
Hello, Mark.
Good to have you back.
We have not done a mano a mano show
in quite a long time. So this week we are going to talk about Coraline, which is a little bit off the beaten track for the VFX show, although not as much as you might think. Once we get into it a little bit more, I think it provides something of a comparison and contrast to some of the other films that we've covered on the show. So, John, first of all, what did you think of the film?
Well, overall, I have to say that I thought it was visually stunning, and I'm sure we'll get into some of that. I was a little disappointed in Hollywood or Selleck or whoever's ability to try and bring Neil Gaiman's, you know, beautiful and haunting and complex vision to light. Gaiman has this thing where, for some reason, he writes so well and he writes such a fully realized world. But then when you try and translate that world, it just never really translates 100% the way that you would expect to the screen. And I think Coraline was no different, you know, than most of the things that we see from, you know, a Gaiman or, you know, I also think Neal Stephenson or, you know, people along that line, like a William Gibson, those guys are also hard to translate to the big screen. And that's a shame because this, while ostensibly a children's story, is really haunting and is really dark and could have been, I thought, a little less of a hand-holding movie that seemed aimed at kids under 12.
Well, I have a couple of kids under 12 in my house, and I will say that I would not be taking them to this movie. So it is actually pretty dark and scary for the under 13s. In the U.S., it got a PG rating, which is a warning to people like me not to take those little ones unless they're kind of jaded and have already seen their 10,000 cop killings on TV. But
so I guess my son seeing Jason X with me would make me a bad parent.
You're an abusive parent, John.
That's, at least as far as the Motion Picture Association is concerned.
That's right. I thought it was a beautiful, I want to say little film, but of course it's not little at all, but it feels very intimate and very enticing. I think even the use of the 3D, you and I saw it in 3D with the goofy glasses on, and we'll get to that a little later. But I thought that the use of that technique itself kind of drew me into this world, and I think I came away with it with some really indelible images and just an overall feeling that I think nicely balanced what could be too self-indulgent a world of, you know, Czech-inspired animation full of strange Eastern European characters and situations, and something that would be produced completely as kiddie fodder. I think it actually pretty nicely found its way down the line there. It's been a big success. It had a big opening weekend. It's made already, according to the estimates I saw, already made double its money back. And that's good news because it means that more films like this will probably be able to be made. But we'll get back to all that. The main thing I think to talk about, first of all, is the stop motion process, because it's pretty fascinating in terms of how it compares and contrasts to CG and to live action filmmaking. John, do you want to talk us a little bit through that process?
Absolutely. I think the absolute irony, at least in my mind, of this film is, had it been anyone else who directed this film or anyone else who was involved, they would have just done this in CG, or they would have done this as a, you know, as a computer animated film or a computer generated film, because I think it would have taken a lot less time and energy.
Although it certainly would have been a lot more expensive.
Do you think that's
ironically
true?
I don't think you could do this film for $35 million in CG.
Yeah, I think that's certainly.
I don't think you could do this film in CG at all. I don't actually in the same film, so
really,
it's something of an academic discussion. But go on with the process and we'll dig in a little bit to where the result differed because of the process.
So maybe the reason that you couldn't have done this film in CG is, you know, just because the cost would have certainly overrun $30 or $35 million or whatever the estimated budget is for this. I feel sad if that's the case, because I feel like that really speaks toward the folks who were involved in this, and that because here's the thing. The people who did the work on this film, the people who did all the puppet work and all of everything that we see on the screen, it just is a tremendous amount of work to me, you know. And one of the things that they did is, you know, they built all of these puppets, certainly, and we know that. But the other thing that maybe we don't know is that they took a lot of the work that they had already done and they modeled everything in, I believe, Maya in this case, and then they output all of those models, those existing models, onto a very specific photopolymer resin prototyping system. And then they started putting together all these different combinations of facial expressions and all of these different parts and pieces to every one of these puppets. And so you have, for any given puppet, you have, you know, between 20 and 50 different pieces that were modeled in Maya and then output in, you know, on a 3D scanner.
Yeah, that's right. So just like any stop motion film, they started with maquettes, they scanned them, those went into Maya, as you said, but it's not as if the whole film was animated in Maya, although they did then rig all the cameras, so they got the raw scan data, which of course you can't rig and animate, and they redid it, but they carefully preserved all the little dimples and imperfections they got by scanning in the maquettes. So that they wouldn't basically vacuum out all of the human element up to this point. This gave them, and this is the key part, this riggable model that could be literally printed out. And the printing process yielded, in particular, a large number of interchangeable face parts. Isn't that right, John?
Yeah, I think one of the estimates I read that was that there were 70... faces, you know, per puppet, essentially, but they weren't really faces, they're half faces. And so just to take a step back, so basically this system that I alluded to earlier, it's what's called an Objet RP Polyjet technology, and what it does is it takes this resin, which is a photopolymer resin, and it is in these cartridges, and it sprays it into a 3D model. Well, as it's spraying the resin, this special UV light hardens it instantly, and each layer of this of these spray jets, each layer is about 4 times thinner than a piece of human hair. So it's about 16 or 17 micron layers thin, right? And so you can get a tremendous amount of detail out of this process. Now, of course, this matters because each of these puppets is about 8 to 15 inches tall. I mean, they're very small, right? And so you really have to get in there and get a lot of fine detail. And they even went way further, which is they built these faces that had these openings in the back where you could actually insert, you know, a teeth, a tongue, all of these different parts and these interchangeable parts to create a lot of these different expressions for each of the puppets. And each of the faces for each of the puppets is also in two pieces. So you have effectively a top and a bottom piece that you can combined to create a lot of different expressions and different looks for each of these puppets.
Yeah, so, I mean, some of the detail that you mentioned in there is, I mean, it's beyond often what you would do in terms of detail on a CG feature, but it also had a different goal in mind. And one goal that they had was to do as little as possible on this film actually in CG. So they did erase the join lines between the top and bottom masks, and they even did a bit of in-betweening, I believe, although they don't like to talk about that so much. They didn't have to do a whole heck of a lot of facial in-betweening because they had so many face shapes. Now, it's interesting to compare this film to a couple of others that Henry Selick did. He hasn't had the green light to do a full-length stop motion Hollywood feature, nor has anybody else, since pretty early in the days of CG animation before it truly took over. And one interesting point of comparison for me is The Nightmare Before Christmas, which was a 1993 feature. And that film, and I don't know if you disagree with me, John, but I think it had a much more stuttery, stop motiony feel, and it's what we think of when we think of stop motion. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know. The problem is I never saw that film in 3D, and I don't know
Well, it
if you saw
didn't,
the film in 3D.
Well, it
I
didn't,
mean,
it wasn't filmed in 3D.
no, but they did re-release it in 3D, I guess. So I guess I'm saying that, not having seen it in 3D and not having seen Coraline in basically 2D, right? I can't really tell if some of the stuttering that I am just completely aware of. I couldn't tell if that was the process of turning it into a 3D feature, or if it was part of the 3D work, or if it was just the stop motion itself, because there's a lot of what I would say stuttering happening, and I'm not sure how much of that is the movement of the puppets or the stop motion, and how much of it is just the way that the camera moves and it's in 3D and the background is shifting, and there's
Okay,
just a
but if
lot going
we
on.
let's suppose then we go back further and we go back all the way to the Ray Harryhausen days and some of the early innovations.
Well, it's clearly inferior to the Ray Harryhausen films. Come on, Mark.
Just in terms of smoothness of motion now, John.
All I want to say is Clash of the Titans.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say, because if you've seen Clash of the Titans, I saw it when I was a kid, and when I was a kid, I thought Clash of the Titans was the single most phenomenal film ever made by anyone in the history of all film. And having
Yes.
seen that recently, not so much.
Yeah, you were that type of boy.
Yeah.
Well, what I'm really getting at here is Harryhausen and Nightmare have in common that they did not actually animate at a full 24 FPS. So it's common in animation not to, it's common to animate what it's called animating on twos, animating on threes. So in other words, you only update every two, three, even fewer frames. It's done for a couple of reasons. One is certainly economy in this case, and in the past, how long it would have taken to create every single film frame of the film. But also, stylistically, it's often what's actually desired. Now, in this case, they did do this whole film on one. So this is a full 24 FPS. I don't know about you, John, but I did notice the faces nonetheless would sometimes kind of hang out in a complete static pose in close up. And I think, it's just a mark of the stop motion style. I think it actually, in retrospect, stood out to me more in this particular film because there was so little of it, or so relatively little of it compared to these other stop motion films that I'm mentioning. So it's a little bit more noticeable, but what I found myself doing was actually comparing it more with CG and even mocap. Were you able to stay out of making that comparison? Did it feel more like these older films or more like a CG film as you were watching it?
Oh, I think it definitely felt more to me like an older stop motion film. I mean, I could absolutely tell the difference. Like you said, there was a little bit of a, what I would call maybe a settle in, where and you see this a lot in a lot of cartoons, a lot of anime cartoons and things, where a lot of things are moving and then all of a sudden things just kind of freeze and they do like a Ken Burns effect or something to kind of take your mind off the fact that things aren't moving. And I felt a lot of that, I mean, a lot of that in Coraline, where something, a tree, a leaf, something that was previously moving would just kind of settle in and stop moving in the background. And now, granted, this was just an enormous undertaking. I mean, no fault of anyone's, right? That things aren't constantly moving. Because, like you said, they did film it at 24 frames per second. There are times when things are just still.
Yeah, I take it to be a stylistic thing. And certainly, in most cases, if they had the option of adding more stuff, like you can easily do these days, they didn't go for it. So I noticed, for example, that the rain was, it consisted of so few drops you could practically count them in midair. On the other hand, some of the stuff that's just about impossible to do as a stop motion model, like flames and liquids and some of the things that really you're just absolutely killing yourself to try to do them in stop motion. Regardless, you know, those they did actually kick over to Houdini, as well as some of the environmental stuff. So the film took on a kind of a surreal quality. Now, did that then feel more like a CG film? Did you think they lost the style of the film there?
No, I don't really think they, you know, it's funny you say that there were some stylistic choices that actually sent that rang a bell for me, and like a light bulb just went off. And, I think that a lot of what I'm taking issue with might just be a stylistic choice that Selleck made. You know, I think back about, there's a film called Monkey Bone that he directed, and there was a lot of, I hesitate to call it stop motion in that film, but it was, you know, there's a lot of CG, a lot of stop motion, a lot of just what I would say high oddness, right? In Monkey Bone. Monkey Bone is a very strange film, and I never really, despite whether it's a good film or a bad film or all of these different things, I never really bought into the stylistic choices that were made. And I think that was one of the problems for me with this film, is I had trouble believing in some of the stylistic choices. Like you said, the very few raindrops, you know, when they're walking along with candles and there are the flames were way too different than the rest of the film. And these are choices I'm sure that they made. These are conscious choices, but I don't know if there were conscious choices that I could personally buy into. I mean, if you haven't seen the film, although I would suspect that you have since you're listening to this podcast, but if you haven't seen the film, if you want to really get a sense of just the weirdness that I'm talking about, go to the Coraline.com website. That is a roller coaster of freak. I mean, it is just such a bizarre experience. It's unlike any website you've been to. You can take pictures and sew buttons into the eyes of photos and put them in weird frames. And it's just complicated and all of these different things.
So. Yes, indeed. So I don't want to get too far off into let me say this. Any stop motion film that doesn't let its freak flag fly, is that a tongue twister? Doesn't let its freak flag fly is probably headed down the wrong road in the first place. This seems to be a style that just loves to use, you know, I'm looking at the list here of the things they did, and it's like kitty litter for the driveway surface, cotton spritz with hairspray for vapor puffs. And, you know, it's really, they made all the little blossoms on the trees. I think they spent, 2 weeks painting individual kernels of popcorn. So they definitely decided to go in the freaky direction. And I don't think we can fault them for that. I actually think, to me, it all holds together. And I'm sympathetic to busting out a little Houdini when you need crazy patterns to make a psychedelic universe kind of erupt around them, or need some candles in the scene. So one thing we like to ask on this show is whether these films obey the laws of physics. Just looking at it that way, I mean, basically, to me, by its very nature, stop motion animation has to obey the laws of physics. And it's interesting to note that in the early days of CG, and here I'm talking about like Pixar 3D animated films, companies like Pixar recruited heavily from people who had worked on films like The Nightmare Before Christmas, because not only did they understand lighting and how to actually light a 3D scene, but also how objects behave without allowing you to completely break the rules. Now, did this film stick with that, John?
Well, I think that it stuck with it in some cases. In other cases, not so much. I mean, if you look at the character Mr. Babinski, played by Ian McShane, which, by the way, is a very strange accent for Ian McShane. I could hear his voice, but then this odd accent, and I kept trying to connect the two. But he is this somewhat tall and bulbous creation that seems to defy the laws of gravity, the laws of physics, whatever you want to say. I mean, he almost scales buildings and these sort of things.
Yeah, he's a completely preposterous character. Now, I don't know if we've mentioned it yet, but you know, everything on this thing was done in one take. So there was compositing certainly involved to remove rigs and so on to get people to fly around and little things to go in the air and so on. But they didn't do it on multiple takes. And that may be some of the reason that this thing wasn't as expensive as your typical 100 take CG feature, 100 takes being maybe the worst case scenario, but nonetheless possible. Simply just not possible on a film like this. I think they built some characters, particularly the mother, once she turns into kind of Spider Lady, who defies physics a bit, but I don't think they completely lost their minds with it. To me, they still were sticking in this world where things have this real physical reality. Like, I just felt it was stylistically consistent. I'm gonna keep arguing that one, John. I just think it was it really held together in that respect.
No, I think it was stylistically consistent. I guess what I'm saying is I'm just not 100% sure on the style that was chosen. And, you know, that's a personal perspective. I mean, there are things about it that I absolutely loved, and I'm sure we'll talk about the 3D aspect of it, because that was certainly at the top of the list.
Yeah, actually, that's a great segue. I want to let you finish, and then let's get into that.
Absolutely. I guess I should summarize my exact feelings on the world that this created. I thought the world was 90% amazing and 10% WTF. And the problem is that the 10% WTF was enough that it pulled me out of it. But the rest of it, you know, the rest of it was just, I mean, if I were in a room with anyone who worked on this, I would certainly say to them, my gosh, you have done such amazing work. You know, it's breathtaking. And I think that's absolutely true.
So this was filmed with, actually each scene was filmed with a single still camera. And they used a camera that I was not familiar with before doing the research on this. John, had you heard of the Red Lake Mega Plus camera? It's apparently used for medical imaging. And I believe the reason they chose it was that it has very nice quiet blacks, so it does really well with the low levels. And a film like this, of course, has a really high dynamic range of lighting in each scene. Had you heard of that camera?
I had not specifically heard of that camera, no.
Yeah, it's probably right out of the experience of anybody listening, unless they do some of these really specialized applications that use it. It actually has a cooled sensor, so it's not a camera you're going to be carrying around with you on vacation. But you may be wondering why there weren't two of them, since it was a 3D film and shot for 3D, and why, in fact, what they did was to move by hand the camera over a little bit. So they'd take one frame, and the animator would move the camera over and take another frame, and then they'd pose the next scene and move the camera by hand. The problem that they had to solve was the interocular distance on these little tiny scenes. Even, you know, if you look at your scale view of the world and how far your eyes are apart, you have to scale that down in order to get the view correct from the camera's point of view. And I just don't think they had a way to do that. Sometimes on a feature film, it's done by shooting the second camera into a mirror, and then you get an inverted image that's usually slightly lower quality that you have to flip. But in this case, they didn't really have the option of doing that due to the size of the lens itself. And so they really did it old school. I assume they had to then track in the distance frame to frame, if it was really truly done that much by hand. And that, anyway, yielded the first true 3D, i.e. shot for 3D stop motion film, which was projected in Real D 3D, the system that is all the rage these days. So, John, how did you like the experience of seeing this in 3D? Did you think it added quite a bit, or was it more, you know, kind of a, I don't know, unnecessary reason to wear goofy glasses?
Well, yeah, those glasses aside, we could spend an entire show just talking about how they could redesign those glasses and make them better.
Yeah.
They are, obviously uncomfortable and all of these other things that you don't want when you're sitting down for 2 hours trying to watch something. I thought, here's the interesting thing about this. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that not only was the 3D in this great, but that this is the best implementation of a 3D film that I have ever seen in my life.
Wow. Okay. So there are a lot of people who would disagree with you and said that the 3D was somewhat superfluous and didn't really grab them, as it were. So why did you think it worked?
Well, I thought it worked for a couple of different reasons, and I thought it worked probably for the same reason that they say that it was superfluous and, didn't really need to be there and all of these other things. I thought the 3D did exactly what 3D should do, but has never not once done in any film prior to this film, which is it served the story. It was a part of the story. And they did this thing where I've never seen this before, where the 3D, rather than coming out of the screen, it went kind of, I would say, behind the screen or into the screen. I took my glasses off several times to compare. Most of the things that were in the foreground were actually not in 3D. If you take your glasses off during the film, you can see that most of the things that are at the very front, at the very frontmost part of the foreground, those are not in 3D. But the things behind the frontmost objects are in 3D. And that gave this film a depth of field, but a three-dimensional depth of field that moved inward. A lot of 3D movies do this kind of ridiculous thing. I know we've all seen Journey to the Center of the Earth, which I won't speak to the film itself, but there are aspects of the 3D in that film that just make me want to gag. Something's flying at you and it's coming out of the screen, and it's just this sort of, it's the equivalent of a cat scare in a horror film. It's just cheap. And this film never resorted to that. It told the story without ever cheapening it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with you. I think having worked on a couple of Rodriguez films where his 3D films where his direction was make it hit me in the eye. I'm sure that this director hardly ever, if ever, said that. And because, it seems not only like a really tasteful choice, but one really appropriate to this film because it's the story of a girl getting drawn into this parallel world. And a lot of the scenes also draw you in the way of a dream. And so it really, for me also, it really added to the mesmerizing effect of the movie, even though it didn't have the wow factor of 3D, which some people have, complained about, that it seemed to them too subtle to be worth the trouble. I don't agree, and I think we're pretty much together on this one. I noticed in the trailers that played beforehand, there were several 3D films that screened their trailers ahead of this in 3D, which was kind of a treat. And it looks to me like Up, the Pixar film, is similarly going to make pretty good use of stuff far, far in the background. I know that getting back to this film, they built the sets as they became more surreal to actually have more physical depth. Since they had no computer control over that difference, the scenes, the rooms were actually built to be, instead of, say, 1 foot deep, they were built to be 4 feet deep to just psychologically add to that depth. So they really thought about it and put it to good use for the story. It was really striking. If you stay to the very end of the credits, there is a gratuitous thing that reaches out and pokes you in the eye. And it was really noticeable because it doesn't happen anywhere else through the whole film. Wasn't that kind of a big shock at the very end?
Yeah, I think, if anything, that was just a wink, right,
Yeah,
to the audience and
exactly.
to everyone who made this film. That was just their way of kind of winking and going, well, here's what we did not do. But, if you stuck around all the way to the end, we'll give a little bit of it to you.
Yeah. Okay, well, so that then I think draws something of a picture of the relationship of this film to, in particular, 3D CG films, and there's certainly more that could be explored there, but we'll probably have a chance to do that because this studio not only has a hit on their hands, but they're backed by Nike money, and so I believe they're going to stay together and make another Henry Selick film, Paranorman, and there are a couple others coming up. Tim Burton is putting one together. And I think even Wes Anderson, have you heard about this? Fantastic Mr. Fox?
Yeah, I've heard about it, but I don't know any of the details.
So it'll be stop-mo in slow-mo. So I really look forward to the new trend of more of this and to how different directors and artists work with this technique. I think it provides a striking contrast, and one that this film succeeded in taking out of its cruder, earlier beginnings into something really quite elegant.
Yeah, exactly. I'm hoping this ushers in a new era of 3D where we're doing 3D, you know, like say the same way we do special effects, where we do it to serve the story, but we're not doing it just for the sort of thrills of it.
Yeah. All right, John. So if people want to find you, where can they do that?
Well, they can find me at the newly minted, recently modified, changed lifezero.org. I moved from one hosting provider to another, and I can't tell you how happy I am to have made that switch. Not that one is better than the other, but that it, you know,
but
it's
it
just it's completely simplified my life and the whole way that I deal with writing blog entries and that whole thing.
Oh, fantastic. I'll have to ask you about that after the show. So, lifezero.org?
.org. I'm also on the Twitter at lifezero, and I'm guessing this show will come out soon, but, you know, I'm in the spirit of Life Zero. One of the tenets is if something new comes into my life, something old has to go out, and I've been acquiring a lot of new things lately, so in an attempt to get rid of old things, I've been... I don't know, maybe generous, maybe crazy, maybe however you want to put it, but I've been trying to get rid of a lot of things to people, and I tend to just say the things that I don't need over Twitter and have a conversation with people who do need them.
And so, are you giving something away?
Well, right now I'm giving away a 1 terabyte G-RAID 2, but
I didn't want to... It'll probably be gone by the time...
I think it's April 2nd is when I'm just, I did a little contest. I wrote a little Python script that randomly grabs a Twitter follower and gives it to them. But, you know, I hate to pimp that because I don't want it to sound like, oh, well, I'm giving something away. So follow me on Twitter, because that's certainly not the case. If you know.
All right, cool. I can be found on Twitter as Flow Seeker. That is also the name of my blog. I have been writing a little bit for Pro Video Coalition and am putting up a first of what may be a series of articles about working with Red and Red footage. After I did a presentation about that, I kind of over-prepared for the presentation, so I'm using some of that data, many of which was stuff I learned from our fine mutual institution, Effects PhD, and the brainchild of our erstwhile and soon-to-return host, Mike Seymour. So that is an excellent place to also learn more about not only the Red camera, but many other things that we've talked about, including, in one case, they did even get into building models along the lines of what was done in this film today. So, John, would you thank our producers and contributors for us, please?
Absolutely. We'd like to thank FX Guide for kindly hosting this bad boy. We'd also like to thank Kristen Martin, who is a producer, does a lot of editing, and actually appears on certain shows. She's tireless and awesome. Lori Apthorpe did the research this time around, and I got to tell you, that was great, because Coraline is a complicated beast to try and understand all of the different things that went into it. So thanks, you guys. You do great work.
So that's all from us for this week. Next week, we will be back with another fantastic film.
Till next time.
Goodbye.